Welcome to the podcast of Focus 580, featuring interviews with newsmakers and experts on international affairs and daily life, hosted by David Inge at WILL Radio, Urbana, Illinois. Please support this service by becoming a member and visit us on the web at will.uiuc.edu.
Good morning, and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Central Appalachia provides much of the country's coal. About 70% of that coal comes from strip mines. And over the past two decades, an increasing amount of that coal comes from mountaintop removal sites. In an effort to cut costs, coal companies have turned away from more conventional kinds of excavation to simply blasting away the tops of mountains. And mountaintop removal is much the way that it sounds. You use high explosives and heavy earth-moving equipment to remove all the material that you don't want so that you can get to the coal. There have been very considerable environmental and social costs of this kind of radical mining. And this morning, in this first hour of the show, we'll be talking about it with Eric Reese, who's written a book on the subject. His book is entitled Lost Mountain, A Year in the Vanishing Wilderness, Radical Strip Mining and the Devastation of Appalachia. It's published by Riverhead Books. Eric Reese teaches writing at the University of Kentucky in Lexington. His work has appeared in a number of publications, including Harper's, Orion, and the Oxford American. In fact, he wrote a story about this technique, about radical strip mining, for Harper's, and that was expanded then to make this book. And for that, he won an award. He won the Columbia University School of Journalism's 2005 John B. Oakes Award for Distinguished Environmental Journalism. And he's joining us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, questions are welcome, as always. The only thing we ask of callers is that people try to be brief so that we can get in as many callers as possible and keep the program moving. But you're welcome to call 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. Eric Reese, hello.
Hello.
Thanks for talking with us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
I appreciate it. Just to start off here, can you describe, give a better, more fleshed out description of what mountaintop removal is and how that is different from more conventional methods for strip mining?
Well, if you imagine an Appalachian mountain as a layer cake, what you have are very thick seams of sandstone, and then you have very thin seams of coal running throughout that sandstone and then layers. And so what happens is these coal operators will take bulldozers and they'll strip all of the trees off of the mountain, and they'll just burn that. They won't even keep that for timber. And then they set off these blasts. It's a mixture of ammonium nitrate and fuel oil, which is what Timothy McVeigh used in Oklahoma City, except these blasts are far more devastating than what he set off, and about 1,000 of them go off every day across Appalachia. And these blasts dislodge all of the sandstone, and then bulldozers just push all of that rubble down into the valleys below. So what you do is you bury thousands of miles of streams, and then the heavy metals and the acid mine drainage from all that rubble pollutes thousands of more miles of streams further down. So there's incredible health problems for the people who are living downstream from this kind of mining. And then once they've blasted down to a coal seam, they'll bring in front-end loaders, and the loaders just scoop up the coal and put it in trucks or on barges and send it away, and then they blast down to the next seam. And so as you mentioned in your intro, they do this because it's the fastest and the cheapest way to get to the coal. It takes, you know, hundreds of men to go underground and mine coal, whereas it could take just as little as a dozen men to set off these blasts and drive the bulldozers and operate a mountaintop removal mining job. So it's very cost efficient, but unfortunately both the environmental and the health consequences are just incredible.
Mm-hmm. If you can see, and there are photographs in the book, and I'm sure that if you could show people what this looked like, it's stunning when you see what this does to the landscape. And and we can talk about that, and we can talk about some more about the health effects. I guess the question I was going for is, I think some people feel that this is one of the biggest underreported or unreported environmental stories going in the United States. So the question is, why is it that this hasn't gotten more attention?
Well, one reason is perspective, because if you're driving, you know, just on an interstate, you know, you're usually in the lowlands, and so you simply don't see it. It's up on the tops of mountains, and really the only way you do really get to understand the expanse of it is either from a plane or from a fire tower. And so there was a group of students from New Jersey came down last week, and we took them up in a plane. And, you know, when you see it from a plane and you just see that there's just hundreds of acres of mountaintops that have just been completely blown away, I mean, it just looks like the moon. It's a remarkable thing to see, but most people don't see it. And so it really does go underreported. And another thing, you know, that kind of frustrates people around here is that every time there's a mudslide in California, that makes the national news. But we have mudslides every week in Appalachia because this mining has loosened so much of the topsoil, and it doesn't get reported. It's like, you know, things that don't happen on the coasts, you know, just don't seem as you know, important to the mainstream media.
One of the things that I know concerns a lot of people is that this is they regard this as a special kind of ecosystem, and that this is doing irreparable damage. How much territory are we talking about? And this is this isolated spots. So if you were flying over, it would look green mostly, but here and there would be these moon-like patches. How much territory are we talking about?
It used to be like that, but because the price of coal always follows the price of oil, in the last few years it has intensified to such a degree that you can fly up the Virginia-Kentucky border and all of Pine Mountain is just a continuous scar on the landscape. So the projections now are that if it continues at this rate by 2010, an area of the state of Delaware will have been mountaintopped, and I would. You know, the rate of the mining is increasing to a point that I think it's going to be more than that. So at this point, it's been 1,000 square miles have been mined using this manner. So it's not just here and there. It really is everywhere. And the fact that two-thirds of the songbirds on the Cumberland Plateau are in decline is a direct result of the fact that their habitat's just being taken away.
Hmm. We have a caller here to bring in the conversation. We'll do that. And again, just let me very quickly introduce our guest, Eric Ries. He teaches writing at the University of Kentucky in Lexington and has authored a book titled Lost Mountain, A Year in the Vanishing Wilderness, about mountaintop removal, this technique of strip mining to get at the coal that's underneath. His book is published by Riverhead. It's an expansion of an article that won him an award for environmental journalism that was originally published in Harper's Magazine. And questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. I have our first caller here in Indiana on our toll free line 4. Hello.
It's, you know, the comment is it's too bad that the real history of America can't be taught to grade school children, because I would imagine raising the consciousness of people and seeing those photographs would be enough to stop that kind of pandering to large manufacturing. I guess my question works around the state itself. I presume it had no laws that would stop any of this sort of thing, or would cause it to go through some sort of process of being checked by, you know, not even our environmental groups, but perhaps just, you know, the regular bureaucracy and stuff. I was wondering if you could talk about that aspect of it, if there is one, and how the state newspapers and media and stuff handled it, pro and con on that sort of thing. It's you know, it's just damn disgusting, really. Thanks a lot.
All right. Well, go ahead, Eric.
In terms of the first comment, something interesting happened a few years back. There was a group of school children who began lobbying the state legislature not to mine Black Mountain, which is the highest mountain in Kentucky. And these school kids got so much press that the company did back off and didn't mine the top of Black Mountain. So I agree with your caller that education at a very young level is the key here. His second question is more complicated because in 1977, Jimmy Carter signed the Surface Mining Control and Reclamation Act, which was supposed to regulate some of this stuff, but the coal industry has found loopholes and ways to get around that. And then in the last 4 years, the President Bush's appointment at the Office of Surface Mining, Stephen Grouse, actually rewrote a key passage of the Clean Water Act, which said that mining waste could be reclassified as benign fill material, which then could be dumped into streams. So you have a very frustrating situation where there are laws, but the laws are not, they're either being rewritten or they're not being enforced at either the state or the federal level. And then, of course, the coal industry gives massive amounts of money to politicians in both parties, and so there really isn't any movement on the state or local level to have the real kind of environmental enforcement and health enforcement that we need. And that's why we had that's one of the main reasons that we had the tragedies over at Sago last month.
Hmm. The caller also asked about newspapers in the region. How have they covered this story?
That's right. Well, when I wrote the Harper's piece, it suddenly started to get a lot of coverage. And I don't know why it took that, you know, that a national magazine, something like that, for it to start getting reported on the local level. Since that happened, the great environmental writer Wendell Berry has organized a group of writers against mountaintop removal, and they have started writing a lot of op-ed pieces, and that little movement has gotten reported on. And it just seems like in the last year, the local media has begun reporting on this, but it's really one of the most missed stories locally.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk about, we talked a little bit about impact on the environment. Let's talk about, let's start with health, I guess, health effects, because also there a lot of concern about the people who live in this area, not just purely from a destruction of the environment point of view, but also from the kind of pollution that results, contamination of water. The people who live around these sites have experienced a lot of health effects, and they believe that it's the result of living next to these places where the ground has been stripped away and the fill has just been dumped, and a lot of pollutants end up in the air and then on the ground and in the water.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, one thing we as Americans really have to begin to understand is you can't separate environmental issues from health issues. It's the same issue. A study was done in Letcher County, Kentucky, where there's a lot of mining going on, and they found that the children suffer from real abnormal levels of health problems that range from diarrhea to nausea to liver problems, constant sores in their mouths. And a lot of this is connected back to the levels of heavy metals and acid that's in the water itself. I interviewed mothers who have to bathe their children in contaminated water because their wells have been cracked. The air around these mines, there's so much coal dust kicked up that people have to mow their grass wearing respirators. You know, a lot of people told me they feel like they're prisoners within their own homes. And then the coal trucks are almost all of the coal trucks are legally overloaded. And in Kentucky alone, 50 people have been killed by coal trucks in the last 5 years, and over 500 have been injured. So the coal trucks rip up the roads. There are incredible hazards on the roads. And so it's quite hazardous to live around these places.
I could imagine that in some places, if this went on, at the very least, that the people in the legislature, in the Kentucky State Legislature, whose constituents were affected by this, would be up in arms about this. Is there no interest in the legislature in protecting these people? Is coal that powerful an interest?
Well, it's interesting because the bills that get written usually come from people in Louisville or in Lexington. The actual representatives from the region, and this is true in Kentucky and West Virginia, they've just been bought and sold by the industry for 100 years, and so they will not do anything that runs counter to the industry. And so as a consequence, there's a bill right now in the state legislature about returning all of this material back to the mine sites, which they could do. They don't have to dump it into the streams. And that bill, they can't even get that out of committee.
Hmm. Well, would there be, given the fact that now there is such a great demand for energy and there is pressure on price, and that people feel that, some people feel at least that this is a resource that, the coal that is, that we should use, would there be a way to do it? To do it in a way that, as far as the companies were concerned, would be cost effective. They could continue to make money and at the same time wouldn't have the kind of environmental impact that this radical strip mining does now.
Well, there's really no way to mine coal on the surface that doesn't cause incredible flooding and erosion and some of these other effects that we've been talking about. And as we know from last month, going underground and mining coal in this country can be deadly. It doesn't have to be. We could put in place the safety measures that Canada has, and it would be much safer to mine coal underground. And it looks like we're beginning to do that. The governor of West Virginia has done that. It looks like in Kentucky we're going to get some better safety bills. So there are better ways to mine coal underground, but of course, you're still looking at things like black lung for the miners. So almost any way you look at coal, you're looking at a very dirty resource. And I know there's all this talk about clean coal and coal gasification, but if you've seen a mountaintop blown away or you've seen a miner with black lung, you know there's no such thing as clean coal. So it's really a matter of shifting the discussion to conservation and alternative energies.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Eric Reese. His book is Lost Mountain, A Year in the Vanishing Wilderness. It's published by Riverhead Books. Eric Reese teaches writing at University of Kentucky in Lexington. Questions here, welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Here's a caller in Charleston, line number 4, toll free line. Hello.
Yes, a couple of things. First, I'd like to say that I had a maternal grandfather and an uncle die of black lung from old shaft mines in Indiana. That's all my grandfather did was mine coal, and he didn't know anything else, and then he paid the price with the black lung. In those days, this has been, 70 years ago, that or more, that he was, on the cutting edge of how they did it then. And originally I am from Indiana, and Terre Haute in particular, and south when I was young, and north when I got a little older, the shovel mining, which I think was the same sort of thing. They blasted, but there was no mountains. They just dug the earth up, converted the farmland and forest and all that was before them, and dug these holes. That some of that stuff, I remember looking down there and just in awe of the chasm that was before me. And in Indiana, I don't think during that early period that they were required to fill those holes up. But north there in of Terre Haute was the They did cover those over. They mined it out or as far as their contract took them, and then they quit. And then the south part, as far as I know, they're using all those old pits for, not a pit, but those canyons for a landfill. And my question, I guess, is the bulk of coal, since, when I were a kid growing up, it was the household, everybody had coal. Coal or wood. Mainly it was coal, and sometimes I remember being poor that ours was a high sulfur. You could see it mixed in with the slag and the slack. That's the ton of slack was a dollar, I think, then. and that's what you burned, and that all went away. And my question is, I guess, is the bulk of mined coal, however it has gotten out of the ground, goes towards power plants?
51% of it does. 51% of all our electricity from power plants comes from coal.
And where does the other 49% go?
Natural gas and oil.
Oh, so they convert it then.
Yeah.
The gasification. Now, lately I've come to some understanding of the refining industry, and if I'm, maybe you can correct me, is that it takes heat to reduce a gallon of crude oil into other products. Would I be correct on that?
I'm not sure.
Uh-huh. Well, then with a lump of coal, say a pound of coal, how do they reduce that to get it into some other element for to be used? The lump of coal, do they burn it?
Yeah, they just burn it in these huge furnaces.
Uh-huh, but the amount of, say, a pound of coal would produce then, after it had been burned, so much of that would go in the air, would it not? And then the elements are reduced for use. Would it reproduce a pound of usable material after the pound of coal had been burned?
There's an equation of how many pounds of coal equal 1 kilowatt hour, and unfortunately, it's not coming to me right now.
Well, then, you've answered my question basically that it the reduction, whether it is whatever the natural resource is, to get it to a point where it will produce, like you just said, 1 kilowatt hour or a gallon of gasoline, and the other byproducts from that, and I think plastic is part of the crude oil, but I'd want to go too far afield here, but it occurs to me that so long as the paradigm by which we live now is continued, that these horrendous things that you, and I've driven through Kentucky, and it isn't pretty. And what I could just see from the interstate, you know, I mean, I think
right.
They hide most of it behind that, you know, where you can't see it.
Right.
But nevertheless, you know, it unless we change the paradigm, then I don't see much future.
Well, that's right. I mean, we're hearing reports every day now about global warming.
Yeah.
And so we're really at a tipping point now where we as Americans have to do some serious soul-searching about the way we consume resources.
Yes, and in America, the biggest consumer of natural resources on the globe, where we make up 2% of the population of the world.
We consume, one American consumes as much as 30 people in India.
And then the higher, the poorer the country, then the higher the ratio by which you would compare consumption of natural resources. Africa comes to mind. And they still burn wood and such, you know, to cook and all those sorts of things.
You know, there's a great story out of Africa, too, and that is a woman named Wangari Maathai won the Nobel Peace Prize last year for a greenbelt movement where she and a lot of poor women just simply began a reforestation project in Kenya because their water was dirty. They had to walk further and further for their firewood. They had no shade. And so now They've cleaned up the water in their communities. They have shade. They have a renewable resource for heating and for cooking, and they have planted, you know, these an entire forest that sequesters carbon from the atmosphere. So there are stories like that that I think are models that we here in the United States, and particularly in Appalachia, could use to begin moving away from coal to something that's clean, something that's healthy, and something that's renewable.
Well, last question, do you perceive, and this may be better for an economist, but I'm sure you're familiar, under the capitalist paradigm that will seek at all costs to maximize profits and to minimize the capital that it takes to make that profit, and do you see that changing?
Well, I mean, you are starting to hear, you know, some talk about carbon tax, and, you know, that I think would be very important One thing that really frustrates a lot of people here in Appalachia is that there's this term economists use, which is externalities, and externalities are all the things that aren't really factored into the cost of something. And so the coal industry likes to tout the fact that coal is cheap, and it is cheap if you don't look at the price that the people who live here and that the land is paying for it to be cheap. So I really think the true cost of coal, were it factored in, we would realize that it's not cheap, but the industry has always treated the people and the region as cheap, and so that has to change.
Just for a second, could we go back to the point before this last one that the caller raised and you talked a little bit about? I'm sure that there are some people who would make the argument that coal is an important resource for the state, and by exploiting that resource, we create jobs and we bring pump money into the economy of the state of Kentucky. And they would say something like, well, if we say that for environmental reasons that this resource is off limits, and say we're not going to do that, then what are we going to do? We have to have something for people
right.
to do.
Right. Well, a couple things. The fact of the matter is that strip mining is actually reducing the number of jobs in the region because it's such a mechanized way of mining coal that you really don't need actually many miners to do it. So we're actually losing jobs because of surface mining. And the Appalachian Regional Commission did a 40th anniversary study of poverty in the area, and they found that every county that has the most strip mining in it is, by county, the most, what they call distressed, the poorest county. So when Lyndon Johnson came in 1964 and announced his war on poverty, the poverty rate in Appalachia was 31%. And it's improved up north, but here in central Appalachia, it stays exactly at 31%. And so I would argue that that strip mining has not brought jobs, it has not brought wealth, it has not brought health to the region. Now, having said that, I wouldn't call for the elimination of anybody's job, but I do think what we need to do is begin shifting towards, I think it has to be reforestation, a major initiative where we can begin replacing jobs in an industry that we know is a finite resource with another resource that is sustainable, like timber and reforestation.
Let's talk with another caller here, Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hi, I haven't been able to listen to your entire program, but I happen to know the former Kentucky Water Commissioner, who actually is a relative. He was suddenly informed that he needed to retire a few years early. He figures he said no once too many times, and he don't know if it was big coal or big chicken, but the clear message was don't protect the water. It's not only the things I've been hearing you mention in the last few minutes, but the effect on the water issues in the state. And, you know, we might feel removed from this, but our own decisions on how big of a house we have, how many kids we have, all these things affect the demand for coal, for electricity, whether we have our computers on all the time when we're not using them, whether we leave our cell phone charger plugged in, and all those little boxes on the ends of the various electronics that we have all consume power, even when the thing that we're even when they're not drawing power to charge whatever it is or supply power to whatever it is they need to supply power to, they're drawing power. And all of us are using more and more, many of us are using more and more power and not thinking about it. I recently cleared off a corner of my desk that hadn't seen the light of day in a couple of years and discovered that I had a nice little hot one of those boxes, and it was attached to an electric pencil sharpener. I thought, my golly, here it's been drawing power all these years, and it had just gotten buried. I didn't need to be doing that. So it's now unplugged, and I just go over and use a mechanical one. We all need to make decisions to cut down on the need for the use of coal and electricity and gas. Thanks a bunch.
All right, thanks.
Yeah, your caller's making an excellent point. Our houses are 38% larger than they were 20 years ago, and fewer people live in them. So we really, one of the things I hope that comes out of all of this is that people living in urban areas really realize that their level of energy consumption is directly related to the pace at which the mountains of central Appalachia are falling. And I think once that connection is made, then people can start doing things that are very easy to do, like replacing their bulbs, their light bulbs, with compact fluorescent bulbs, by buying an Energy Star refrigerator, things that are not inconvenient at all.
Other questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Well, we talked a little, have talked a little bit about, and generally about environmental impact. We have talked a little bit about health impact. Going back to the first thing a little bit more, one of the things apparently has happened is that as a result of taking the material off, the overburden, as they call it in the business,
right,
taking the material that they don't want off the tops of the mountains and then just dumping it into the valleys, it has completely messed up the drainage patterns of the areas around the places where these mines are located. So as you said earlier, there are a lot of mudslides, but apparently also there's serious problems with flooding that hadn't existed before.
There's a little town called McRoberts. It's a little headwater community, and the company that has mined around it has stripped off all of the vegetation on the ridge sides and on the top of the mountain as well. So you can imagine this town is sitting at the bottom of a giant funnel, and whenever it rains, there's nothing to hold the water back. And in a 10-day period, McRoberts had three so-called 100-year floods that almost just completely wiped away these people's homes, their carports. I mean, it's just been devastating, and that's happening more and more. We're a region that's very prone to flash flooding, and when you alter the ecosystem in this way, you know, you're just gonna get this more and more. And so, yeah, the flooding has really been a problem. And to get back to the first point your caller made about the water quality, the EPA EPA study found that 95% of headwater streams in Appalachia have been degraded by this type of mining. And all of the microinvertebrates that live at the headwaters have been decimated, and as a consequence, the food source all downstream has disappeared. And so it's really just caused incredible problems with water quality. And as far as her friend, her relative, being forced into early retirement, that story gets told over and over again, both in the Department of Interior and the Department of Labor, where people like Jack Spadaro, who I write about in my book, actually try to enforce the law, and as a result, they get forced out of their jobs.
Let's talk with someone else. Here's a caller in Champaign. It's line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes, I was calling actually with an energy question, kind of in response to the last caller, about conceptions and misconceptions about power in the home. And one of the concerns that comes up again and again is leaving, shutting your heat down when leaving the house, turning your heater, turning your furnace off completely when gone, and then returning the house and starting your heater up, your furnace up over again to reheat the house from scratch. And another one is whether that is a reality of actually leaving things plugged in in your house. And, for example, an open-ended charger or something, and whether in reality that actually is using electricity or whether that is not, whether that's just sitting there. Because I've heard so many different things in regard to that, whether that's true or not. If if this person knows whether that's true or not. Thank you.
Unfortunately, I don't. My expertise lies more at the extraction of coal than at the consumption of it. So I've heard conflicting things about both of those, but I can't really answer that.
All right. Well, I think that one thing that is that the caller points to that actually is true has to do with thermostat setbacks. And I believe, and I should not pass myself as an expert, but I believe the standard advice is that you should never set your thermostat back more than 10 degrees, because what the caller says is right, that you actually then will use more energy to heat the house back up to a comfortable level than if you had just turned it down a little bit during the time that you weren't there. So I suppose that there are a lot of things that people can do to reduce their energy use. That's not a question. Although I think, though, that probably it's good that people make sure that anything that they do actually does reduce their energy use, because I suppose it's possible that in the interest of doing the right thing, you might do something that would end up being counterproductive.
There's a nice documentary called Kilowatt Hours about this. If your callers are interested, that really looks at this about doing home energy audits and really thinking about ways that you can cut down on your consumption.
Yeah, it certainly is true that I'm sure that all of us, maybe not all, many of us do waste energy, and that there are a lot of ways to make homes more energy efficient. Simply putting more insulation in your attic would do that. Well, let me again introduce our guest. Eric Reese is the guest here in this hour of Focus 580. He teaches writing at the University of Kentucky in Lexington. His work has appeared in a number of places, including Harper's, Orion, the Oxford American. He's the author of a book entitled Lost Mountain, A Year in the Vanishing Wilderness, Radical Strip Mining and the Devastation of Appalachia. It's published by Riverhead Books. It is an expansion of an article that he wrote for Harper's that won him an award, the Columbia University School of Journalism's 2005 John B. Oakes Award for Distinguished Environmental Journalism. And it's an exploration and explanation of the technique, the radical strip mining technique of mountaintop removal, which, as he has explained, pretty much is what it sounds like, taking off the tops of mountains, taking the material that you don't want and simply dumping it so that you can get at the coal that is underneath. That a kind of a thing that is becoming more and more a more and more common method of strip mining with very serious environmental effects on the environment and on the health of people who live around these places. Questions welcome. We do have a number, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Next up is Kankakee, line number 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Your caller apologizes for not having heard the program, but he would wish to know first, does the author desire that coal should not be mined? And second, how can Appalachia be restored? Thank you.
Okay. So I don't think that you're arguing against coal mining.
No. I'm under no illusions that we're going to be through with coal in the near future, though I do want to see a lot stricter enforcement of safety laws in terms of underground mining. As far as surface mining, as I've said before, I do not think there's any good way to surface mine coal. And because both the extraction of coal is so dangerous and the burning of coal causes so much carbon to be released into the atmosphere, I think we really do need to think very quickly and very seriously about alternative energies. As far as the second part of the question, there is so much abandoned landmine now that we could employ a whole generation in reforestation and in forest management in this area. If we could begin by getting the federal government even to release that money from the abandoned mine lands fund and then do something like raising the severance tax on coal so that there would be more money to do this kind of reforestation. And I really think that's going to be the key to reclaiming this land.
So you are saying that it would be possible to restore this land, that while really all we're talking about here is money.
Yeah, there's been 20 years of studies that have shown that if you don't compact the rock up there on the mine sites, that if you leave it in piles, even without topsoil, you can put in saplings and they will grow at twice the rate that they grow in the forest, because the rock that they're in is so loose and there's so much room for the roots to move. And there are test sites that I can point to where this kind of reforestation is being tried up on the mine sites, and they're very successful. So this can be done. We do not have to practice the kind of reclamation that's done now, where companies simply spray an exotic grass on the mine site and leave. We could do some actual real reclamation. We obviously wouldn't be getting the mountaintops back, but we could at least reclaim the land that has been mined in a responsible way.
Right, let's go to line number two. This is someone in, line number three in Chicago.
Hello. Hi.
Yeah.
I tuned in late, so I don't know exactly in which direction your program is headed. If it's for reforestation, that's one thing, but I was thinking in terms of the use of coal and other coal-based fuels. And I believe from all the reading I've done, and based on whatever scientific evidence there is available, mainly that any fuel that has carbon in it is a danger to the population of the earth. It consumes the oxygen, and it leads to the heating of the atmosphere and all that sort of stuff, pollution of the environment. And we're at a limit now, where, and possibly already past that, maybe it's irreversible. At least some of the experts think we're pretty near the point where the situation is irreversible, where we can't afford to burn any carbon-based fuel, that is coal, oil, gas, lumber, and so on. And unless you can find some chemical way of not using the oxygen from the air to utilize the carbon and trap it so that it doesn't get into the atmosphere, there isn't any use for this stuff as far as the human being is concerned. The only thing is alternative fuel. But there's another area which is never touched in these discussions, and that is that a large part of the problem is caused by the fact that the Earth and the United States are overpopulated. You take the demographers, and they tell you we have 6.5 billion people on Earth, that the Earth has the resources only to support about 2.5 billion people. The United States is overpopulated, has 300 million people. It has the resources to support only about 125 to 150 million people, and which means that we need birth control systems, possibly births limited to one child per family and that sort of thing. And anything else is a lot of hot air.
Well, that sort of the population issue is kind of a different sort of thing. I don't know if you feel like you want to talk about that, but certainly the issue of carbon-based fuels does connect with what we're talking about here.
I think these issues are really all interrelated. I think the population problem does play into this. I mean, if you look at the fact that China is going to build one coal fire plant every week for the next 10 years, that's really scary. and India as well. So if the rest of the world starts consuming at the rate Americans consume, your caller is absolutely right. We have absolutely no future. So, we really have to, you know, it's frustrating to look at the current administration and see how the fossil fuel industry is subsidized, whereas alternative fuels get almost nothing. And yet we know realistically that that's the direction we're going to have to go. We just can't keep pumping carbon into the air like this.
Well, let's go to another caller here, line one. This is Champagne. Hello.
Hi. I just wanted to call following up on a couple of your previous calls. They were talking about wasted electricity from appliances being plugged in. There's actually some good research that puts numbers on that. Apparently, it's about 5% of residential electricity use in the U.S., and that totals about 5 gigawatts. So it's a pretty substantial amount, and that's mostly from things like video equipment, audio equipment, things that it has the off button, but it's actually an idle button.
Mm-hmm.
So just a couple of numbers for you.
All right. Well, thank you for the go.
Yep.
Others are welcome here. We have about maybe 5 minutes left in this part of Focus 580 with Eric Reese. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. We've talked about the fact that people who live in the areas around the places where this kind of strip mining has been done have experienced a lot of problems with flooding, because the blasting apparently is so severe, it shakes the ground so much that people's foundations of their homes have cracked.
Right.
They're dealing with problems with polluted water, with other kinds of pollutants surrounding the environment, making them sick and making their kids sick. We also talked about the fact that these are not wealthy people and that maybe they don't have the kind of voice that people who would have more money and would have more clout would have. But having said all that, they have indeed tried to organize to protest this method of mining and what it has done to them. How successful have their organizing efforts been?
Well, it's interesting. You know, Appalachia is a very religious place, and I think there's a kind of religious fatalism that you sort of feel there. But in the last few years, and that fatalism gets compounded by the fact that the industry is so powerful, but in the last few years, you know, the conditions have just gotten so bad that people have you know, developed this kind of, I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore attitude. And last summer, a group formed called Mountain Justice Summer, and it was people from all over the country coming together for 3 months of real inspired, nonviolent civil disobedience, and they actually got a permit shut down at a processing plant right behind an elementary school where the kids were just having incredible health problems. And so there's a lot of grassroots organizing now, and it's you know, people pretty much know that the federal government's not going to do anything, the state government isn't going to do anything, and so, you know, it's kind of like the Don Cheadle character said in Hotel Rwanda, you're just going to have to shame these people into doing the right thing, and there seems to be a lot more commitment on the ground now of people getting ready to do that.
All right, let's talk with another caller here on our line number one. That's Champagne.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I used to live in Pennsylvania where they did a lot of strip mining. And finally, the state said you can do strip mining, but you must restore the country like it was before you did your strip mining. And I have seen some of the places where they've done it. And after about 5 years, it doesn't look too bad, really.
Yeah, Pennsylvania's done a good job of some of their reclamation. Unfortunately, in Kentucky, the mountains are so steep that you really have gravity working against you, and there's really no way to restore a mountaintop to its original contour. And there's what the operators do is they just do the cheapest thing possible, which is they turn it into quote unquote wildlife habitat. And it's interesting because what they do is they plant lesbedeza, which is a legume that the wildlife won't even eat. I could take you to sites that were reclaimed 30 years ago, and there's still almost nothing growing there.
Oh, my. Thank you. Interesting program.
All right. Thanks for the call. We are getting down to the point here where we're almost out of time, and we're almost at the point we have to wrap up. Just going back to what we were talking about earlier about the fact that here some people would say this is one of the biggest uncovered or undercovered, underreported environmental stories going, and that you say that in part because of some activism, because of the fact that media is starting to pay some attention to it, and you certainly had something to do with that, it is starting to get some more attention. I guess I wonder, generally speaking, whether you're optimistic or pessimistic about something changing here.
Well, I mean, I've lived here my whole life, so I know that change can be very, very slow. I'm not sure I would honestly say I'm optimistic, but I'm also I believe that, you know, this is a fight that has to be fought, and you know, when I get to the end of the day, you know, when my children or grandchildren ask me, I want to say that this is the side I was on. You know, I was on the side of the people who were fighting for the for their national heritage.
Well, I appreciate you giving us some of your time to talk about the story this morning.
Well, thanks for having me.
Our guest in this hour is Eric Reese. He teaches writing at University of Kentucky in Lexington, has written for a number of publications, including Harper's, Orion, and the Oxford American. And in fact, he wrote an article on the subject for Harper's that won an award. It won the Columbia University School of Journalism 2005 John B. Oakes Award for Distinguished Environmental Journalism. And then he expanded that, and that is how we have the book that we mentioned this morning. It's entitled Lost Mountain, A Year in the Vanishing Wilderness, and that book is published by Riverhead Books. So if you're interested in the story, you can seek out the book. Also, he wrote an article on the subject for Orion magazine, and this is the January-February issue of this year. So they do have a website. I don't think that you can read the article for free on the web, but there, if you're interested in the magazine, you can find out more about it by going to their website, and then you might have to go down to the library and hunt up the magazine. Or, of course, you can go down to the bookstore if you want to read Lost Mountain, and you can find the book right there.